This is an author interview from the JAMA Network. This is Jan Engmeyer with JAMA Internal Medicine. Hundreds of thousands of patients in the U.S. have cardiovascular implantable electronic devices. For seriously ill patients with a terminal prognosis, either the patient or their surrogate has to consider deactivation of those devices. A new study describes the features and outcomes of patients who underwent cardiac device deactivation, and an accompanying invited commentary provides insights on the larger end-of-life questions from the patient's point of view. Here to tell us about those two articles are Ms. Lillian Buchalter, a fourth-year medical student from Mayo Medical School, and Dr. Sunita Puri from Hospice and Palliative Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Welcome to both of you. Ms. Buchalter, let's start with you. Please tell us the objective of this study and why it was conducted.
As you mentioned, in the United States, there are currently millions of patients with cardiac devices in place and hundreds of thousands more being implanted every year. With an aging population and this increasing prevalence of devices, we think that there's very strong likelihood that there'll be an increase in deactivation requests in the future. Our aim here was to generate an idea of the type of paths these patients take at the end of life. Another goal was to produce practical information for practitioners, patients, and families. Questions like average survival after device deactivation are extremely understandable, and the size of the study allows some limited inference in these situations.
What were the main findings of the study?
So very briefly, we reviewed the medical records of all patients requesting deactivation during about a four-year period, so we had 150 subjects. So we have demographic information on all of these patients, and we looked particularly at the use of surrogate decision makers, palliative care and ethics consults, as well as advanced directives. We also gave particular attention to survival after deactivation. We found that almost 90% of patients had passed away within a month of deactivation, with median survival ranging from 0 to 3 days, depending on the type of device deactivated. That being said, we did have a minority who survived much longer, so discussions about survival should take individual clinical contexts into consideration.
Dr. Puri, did any of the findings surprise you?
The findings did not surprise me. Rather, they reinforced for me the importance of starting earlier conversations about the importance of end-of-life planning for patients who are sick enough to require cardiac devices. I was surprised that only one patient had addressed device deactivation or their wishes around the device in their advance directive.
Ms. Buchalter, were there any physician refusals or ethics consultations for these deactivation requests?
So the reason for deactivation requests tended to fall into two general categories. One common reason was concern about shocks during the dying process. Other studies have indicated that this isn't an uncommon experience in patients with ICDs who are approaching death. The other general theme was patients and families who were expressing a desire to avoid the device interfering with what they felt was a natural death. And obviously, natural death meant different things to different people. But it's worth noting that within our group, all but one of the patients had terminal or poor prognoses, so this was a very immediate issue. With regard to deactivation refusals, there were only two physician refusals, and they were both in patients who were pacemaker-dependent and very ill. In our experience, it's this category of patient that tends to grapple more with refusals. One patient actually passed away before the requested ethics consultation could be carried out. But in general, guidelines protect conscientious objection, and they establish the right of providers to not carry out deactivations that they're uncomfortable with and the right of patients to have their care transferred. So this is the Heart Rhythm Society guideline, but it's also very well established as our institutional policy, and it has been so for years. We think that the rarity of these refusals represent pretty clear guidelines and general trending towards acceptance of the legal and ethical permissibility of deactivations. Ethical consultations were also very rare. We had three within our study. One consultation addressed interfamilial conflict with different surrogates wanting different things for a patient. Another ethical consult was used for a patient who had inconsistent requests regarding end-of-life care. And the final ethics consult addressed conflict between the desires of a patient who is no longer decisionally capable and his surrogate. And on all of those cases, the ethics consultations were able to resolve the conflict.
Dr. Puri, your commentary really focuses on the need for collaboration and communication. Can you please tell us why those are so important in these cases?
Absolutely. So I see collaboration and communication as involving two sides. On one side, you have the patient and family as well as the specialist. the specialist in this case would be the cardiologist. On the other side, you have myself from palliative care and the cardiologist. And communication and collaboration is necessary on both ends of that spectrum. In particular, I think that collaboration and communication need to happen further upstream. And I actually see the very implantation of a cardiac device as an opportunity for a conversation about prognosis. Just like prognosis should be discussed when somebody is starting, for example, hemodialysis or chemotherapy, it's important to think about the implantation of a cardiac device along the same lines. What I mean by that is that somebody who is sick enough to have a pacemaker or somebody who is sick enough for an AICD is also sick enough to have a very clear conversation about their prognosis, both with their specialist and potentially with a palliative care specialist if appropriate, and to make decisions about when and if they may not find that the implanted device makes sense for them and their life at a certain point. So collaboration in that sense would involve the cardiologist consulting palliative care, if appropriate, and it would also involve the cardiologist seeking advice from palliative care, if not a formal consult, about how to have those conversations. And that needs to happen further upstream to avoid conversations in the midst of worsening acute illness, particularly in the ICU or CCU or other acute settings. I also think that having robust advanced care planning involves really making sure that the patient understands why such conversations are important. Advanced care planning discussions, in my opinion, are far from straightforward. They are not just about code status. They're about what somebody really holds dear in their life and what they value and what role an advanced medical intervention ranging from hemodialysis to chemotherapy to a cardiac device, what role that would play in helping an individual patient to achieve the things that they find important in their life. So not only does an advanced care discussion involve that, it also involves identifying a surrogate who is reliable and can best represent that patient's wishes when they're no longer able to. So very upstream collaboration between the patient, family, and the specialist, as well as the specialist and the palliative care doctor, I think improvement on both fronts will help us as a society to avoid some of the pretty wrenching conversations and pretty wrenching situations that we find patients in at this moment in time.
Ms. Buchalter, would you like to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think the study that we've presented here actually identified one of those such moments and how it was missed. So about half of our patients did have living wills, and as we've pointed out, only one of them used device-specific language. But another interesting thing was half of these advanced directives were actually executed after the device was in place. So a patient had a pacemaker or ICD placed and then had an advanced directive written. With that in mind, that's an opportunity for improvement and sort of a missed moment, in our opinion.
Is there anything else that either of you'd like to add that you think we haven't covered?
I do have something that I want to add on this front. So I think that advances in medical technologies and the training that we give the physicians performing those technologies, they necessitate advances in communication about the technologies. I have a lot of empathy for my colleagues who are pressed for time and don't necessarily know how to broach conversations about why they're performing an intervention. And I consider a part of my role in palliative medicine as helping my colleagues acquire the skills they need or improve upon the skills many of them already have those conversations in a way that's respectful of their time and also respectful of their patients' wishes. I've also found that many of my colleagues in cardiology really want to know how to improve in having those conversations and don't necessarily want to have another physician have those conversations. And I think one area of improvement is really focusing in cardiology education and fellowship training on how you have conversations about issues like device deactivation and how you clarify someone's wishes and values at the time of their device implantation.
Also, in response to Dr. Puri's earlier comments about collaboration, one area of interest that emerged from this study was the experience of surrogates who were requesting deactivation. In our study, a deactivation had to be requested with no input from the patient to be classified as surrogate requested, but many of the people that were grouped into the patient requested category involved shared decision making between patients and family members. So it's clear that between these two groups, surrogates are very frequently involved in the end-of-life process, and we think that another area of interest for future exploration would be the perspectives of these surrogates.
Well, thank you to Ms. Lillian Buckhalter and Dr. Sunita Puri for talking with us about the patient experience of cardiac device deactivation. This is Jan Engmeyer with JAMA Internal Medicine. For more JAMA Network podcasts, visit us online at jama.com.